Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Are you the one?
Are you the one?
You're the one.
George Bush himself said the entire reason for the surge was to create an environment for political progress. Everyone, from the Iraq Study Group to even Bush, have recognized, and if Bush recognizes it, man, it's really got to be out there. Even President Bush recognizes that unless the Sunni and Shia reach some political reconciliation, there cannot be stability in Iraq. And the problem with this definition and evaluation of whether progress has been made is that there has been no meaningful political progress.
So, are you still wondering of the political candidates? Are you the one to win the war or get us out of Iraq? At the Democrats' debate on Monday night, we heard a minority opinion these days articulated there that the surge is failing. We also heard the rising fear that President Bush is about to tie the hands of whoever the next president is by signing an agreement with Iraq for a long-term military presence.
There is a big problem looming on the horizon that we had better pay attention to, and that is President Bush is intent upon negotiating a long-term agreement with Iraq, which would have permanent bases, permanent troop presence, and he claims he does not need to come to the United States Congress to get permission. He only needs to go to the Iraqi Parliament.
Now, that concern is pretty different from what John McCain told a questioner at a town hall meeting in New Hampshire this month. The audio is not the best on this, but listen carefully to his reference not only to Korea and Japan as models, but right near the beginning, the possibility of staying in Iraq for 100 years.
President Bush has talked about our staying in Iraq for 50 years.
Maybe 100.
We've
been in South Korea. We've been in Japan for 60 years. We've been in South Korea for 50 years or so. That'd be fine with me. As long as Americans are not being injured or harmed or wounded or killed, it's fine with me. I hope it would be fine with you if we maintain a presence in a very volatile part of the world where Al-Qaeda is training, recruiting, and equipping and motivating people every single day.
So, in our Super Tuesday primary series, Are You the One? We ask, are you the one to do the right thing, whatever that is, about Iraq? With me now to help sort out the candidates' ever-evolving stance on the war is George Packer, who has covered the war for The New Yorker, written the much-acclaimed Iraq book, The Assassin's Gate, and now has an Iraq war-related play opening this weekend called Betrayed. It begins previews tomorrow at Culture Project, 55 Mercer Street. Packer also has an article in this week's New Yorker, not about the war, but comparing Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama's fundamental ideas about the presidency. So we will try to talk about all of this stuff. Hey, George, welcome back to WNYC.
Good to be with you, Brian.
Hearing Clinton and Edwards and McCain there, we'll hear from other candidates as we go along. Am I right to think there couldn't be more of a difference between the two parties' presidential hopefuls on what they'll do on day one about the war?
Or at least what they're saying they'll do now. And you're absolutely right. I gave a talk at Dartmouth the night before the New Hampshire primary, in which I said, whatever happened to the Iraq war? Why isn't it a fundamental central issue in this campaign? It had faded.
It shows how headline-driven we are as a society, and it's really kind of shameful that if people aren't getting blown up in, you know, front-page roadside bomb attacks every day, the presidential candidates aren't talking about an ongoing war where we still have over 100,000 troops.
It's amazing. And for the Democrats, it's become a kind of a one-liner to win applause before Democratic audiences. For most of the Republicans, they don't mention it at all. I mean, when did you last hear Giuliani, Romney, Huckabee give a serious address about Iraq or even mention it more than in a half a sentence? McCain is the one exception. And I think if McCain is the Republican nominee, Iraq will become a central issue in the general election.
Because he has this position.
He's staked
it
out. That
we just heard there. The questioner said, the president, you know, President Bush has said we might be in Iraq 50 years. And McCain volunteered. He said maybe 100 years.
Yeah, I think for McCain, Iraq is the central front in the war on terror, as the administration's been saying. That is his core position. And for us to leave Iraq, in McCain's view, would be to leave it to ultimately to terrorists, or at least to insurgents and militias that are closer to terrorists than we would like, and to signal to al-Qaeda that we're retreating. And that for him is defeat. He sees it in very black and white terms, victory or defeat, and he actually thinks something called victory is still possible in Iraq.
If the Democrats have not been talking about Iraq very much, it's at least in part because the surge is widely perceived as working. We heard John Edwards in that clip willing to go to the place of saying, no, the surge isn't working.
Right. Well, this is a semantic dispute that has both political and real implications. What is the surge and what was its goal? Well, John McCain is now claiming that the goal of the surge was to pacify Baghdad and to stabilize Iraq. And he associates it entirely with military strategy. He talks about Petraeus. He doesn't talk about diplomacy. He doesn't talk about politics. I heard a questioner in New Hampshire ask him, what about diplomacy and politics? And he actually just didn't answer the question. So I don't even think he sees Iraq in those terms. The Democrats are seizing on the fact that the White House played the surge from the beginning as a chance for the Iraqi factions to come to some, if not reconciliation, at least an accommodation. And in spite of sort of a mixed debathification law that is passed, that hasn't happened. And so they're saying it's a failure.
And the White House has really changed on this, because when the surge was first announced, it was announced in conjunction with some benchmarks for measuring the success of the surge, including an oil law, bringing the Sunnis legitimately into the political process and the government, some other things. And now I think the line out of the Bush administration is those benchmarks are now irrelevant.
I think at some time over the summer, Bush began to talk about bottom-up reconciliation and bottom-up progress, meaning let's forget what's happening in the green zone between Iraqi politicians. Let's look at what's happening in Ramadi or in Mosul, which is now under curfew because of a suicide bomb, or in Najaf. And credible, honest observers tell me that those places have dramatically improved.
And the bottom-up idea means the groups of people on the ground starting to make peace with each other rather than looking to the political sector to do it.
Exactly. So the mayor of Fallujah and the police chief of Fallujah make a deal with the governor of Karbala province to respect the provincial line and to give each other intelligence and to join forces against insurgents. And
even if the Maliki government can't act. Have a point.
Right. Even if the Maliki government won't take the new Sunni militias that are in league with us against al-Qaeda and absorb them into the government, they do have a point.
So do you think that based on all your reporting in Iraq that the Bush administration has a legitimate point that the surge is working, maybe not to do the things that they thought it was going to accomplish, but that it has created the conditions for this more local-based spread of peace?
Well, I should say I haven't been there since last January, okay. And that means the war has gone through maybe four radical changes. That's what always has happened in Iraq, and we're the last ones to hear about it. The Iraqis know. The Americans find out a few months later. So my knowledge is secondhand, but what I hear from both Iraqi friends, from American correspondents, from soldiers, is places that we as journalists used to dread even hearing the name of, you can now go into. You can spend a few hours in Dora, which is in southern Baghdad. Again, a name that was just death for Westerners and for Shiites and for pro-government Iraqis. You can now go into for a few hours and interview a member of the so-called Sunni Awakening, and then get out before you try your luck too far. That, to me, is a pretty dramatic change from 1 year ago when I was last in Baghdad.
My guest on WNYC is George Packer, who has covered Iraq for The New Yorker, wrote the book The Assassin's Gate, has a play opening tomorrow at Culture Project 55 Mercer Street called Betrayed, and to boot, has an article in The New Yorker this week comparing Clinton's and Obama's view of the presidency, and we'll try to get some calls in for him, but we have some tape of other candidates to play, and we're really trying to give you some information about where the candidates stand on the war relative to each other. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, and we'll talk about the play as well. Which Iraq war is the play set in, since it seems like you're saying the war changes every 3 months?
It's at the rock bottom. of Baghdad. It's 2006, early 2007, when Baghdad was a dying city and when Iraqis were fleeing it in large numbers and when everyone I knew who had anything to do with either the American military or the embassy or Western journalists was in hiding or trying to get out of the country. It was a terrible place. It felt being in Baghdad in January of last year, I had the feeling of being at the end of some terrible disease that had ravaged the city and was about to kill the city. And that's why what's happened in the last year does make an impression. But the play looks back on the whole course of the war through the point of view of two young Iraqis who are remembering it in a hotel room at this terrible moment and remembering their hopes and their disappointments over the 4 years of the war.
And the title of the play is Betrayed, which is a very loaded word in this context. Remember when General Petraeus was coming to do his testimony on the surge a few months ago and MoveOn had that ad that used the word Betrayus, rhymes with Petraeus, and it was just seen as so toxic by so many people.
Yeah,
that's the title of your play.
It is, but it has nothing to do with MoveOn's ad, which I didn't like. It has a lot to do with Iraqis who not only fasten their hopes onto the American project, the American presence, but also risk their lives for it and found out that the Americans, officially at least, were unwilling and not even indifferent to their security, unwilling to protect them, to help them. And so the betrayal is pretty deep, but it's a betrayal of the Iraqis, not of the American public.
And I know the war has been out of the news a little bit lately, but one reason this is important right now, again, to the presidential candidates, and we heard Clinton articulate it in that clip. I'm very curious to see if the Republicans will be asked about this tonight in their debate. We'll have that at 11 p.m. on AM 820 tonight, that Republicans debate from Florida. The reason is that the president is apparently on the verge of some sort of long-term commitment of American forces in the country. Now, here is a montage played on Morning Edition today of various administration officials hinting at what they may announce very soon.
We're now building an enduring relationship with Iraq.
A long-term strategic partnership.
And we look forward to a relationship with Iraq for the long term.
A mutually agreed arrangement whereby we have an enduring presence.
George Packer, and the last voice was Robert Gates, the defense secretary. What does it all mean?
I don't think it means a whole lot, frankly. I think it is this administration's attempt to put a kind of final seal on the war and to create a legacy that isn't just a legacy of failure. And I think the next administration will do whatever it wants in Iraq, regardless of this agreement. It's not going to be binding. Bush has said he's not going to go to Congress with it. It is between the administration and the Iraqi government, and I think it will end if there's a new administration that doesn't want it. But, you know, I interviewed Hillary Clinton last week for the New Yorker piece. And at one point we were talking about Iraqi translators who worked with the U.S. And she has mentioned them often in her speeches and said we have a debt to them. And she said something like, I'm going to paraphrase, this is one of the reasons why I'm not quite as dogmatic or rigid as some of my opponents about leaving Iraq, because I know some of the consequences that would happen to people like that if we do leave. And so she signaled to me that although she has now taken to saying on the campaign trail, I will begin bringing troops home within 60 days, I will end the war, my guess is Hillary Clinton will hedge her bets and will wait to see, and perhaps because she's been in the White House, knows that tying her own hands before becoming president would be the worst thing she could do.
And I want to play the clip from Monday night's debate in which Obama hedged his bets. Remember, they were responding to Edwards, who really set the tone on a number of topics on Monday night.
He did. Yeah.
Edwards saying that he would have all combat troops out of Iraq within his first year in office. Clinton said what you just described. And Obama was careful to be somewhat nuanced in this way.
What I've said, and I've said repeatedly, is I want to be as careful getting out as we were careless getting in, but I want to make sure that we get all our combat troops out as quickly as we can safely.
So as careful getting out as we were careless getting in, that does not sound like a rapid withdrawal, and certainly he didn't make a commitment to any kind of timeline. How different are Obama and Clinton on this?
Well, Obama was saying for a long time, perhaps two brigades a month. combat troops. It was as if he had a kind of force march plan in mind that would be on a schedule. In other contexts, he's kind of backed off that and said as careful as and as quickly as possible, but carefully and safely. I think my guess is, and it's only a guess, Hillary Clinton would be more would be slower, more cautious, would probably leave more troops in longer than Barack Obama. But I don't know that for sure. And Barack Obama might think one thing now and find something quite different if he becomes president. Namely, what if whole areas of Iraq begin to disintegrate? What if al-Qaeda returns to Baghdad in a big way, to Anbar province in a big way? Bases begin to be set up. Are we really going to be on the highways to Jordan and Kuwait as quickly as possible while cities are visibly on television screens across the world being taken back by al-Qaeda? I think it'll be very difficult for any president.
So if a Democratic primary voter is still concerned about getting out of Iraq as quickly as possible, then there's a clear choice of Edwards among these top three, and certainly Kucinich, if you go to Kucinich. And if they're concerned about getting out of Iraq quickly but only are really considering Clinton or Obama, then they can't really decide on that, it sounds like you're saying.
I don't think that there's an obvious difference. I don't think anyone can be sure of what they would do if they get to the White House. I don't think that what they're saying now should be a bet for what to expect in January 2009.
So I want to ask you about the difference between the remaining leading Republicans. And since it looks like it's coming down to a McCain-Romney one-on-one pretty soon, and Giuliani has largely the same position as McCain, so we should say that. But my question is, how different are McCain and Romney when it comes to the war? Let's listen to a little bit of Mitt.
I do not support and have never support a timed withdrawal. So that's wrong, Governor. You know, it's really helpful if you talk about your policies and the things you believe, and let me talk about my policies. And my policy is I've never talked about a timed withdrawal with a date certain for us to leave. That's not the case. Simply wrong.
So Romney going toe-to-toe with Huckabee in the last ABC debate. George Packard, does Romney have an identifiable position?
As on most issues, it's kind of hard to pin it down. I think he ran an ad recently that had him strolling across the front lawn of a suburban home that might have been his in a blue button-down shirt, looking like a financial advisor in a Charles Schwab commercial and saying, Islamic terrorism, it's the 21st century's biggest nightmare. And he was trying to outdo Giuliani and McCain as a national security hawk, really playing on fear of terrorism. And I think it's for the same reason that he went after the immigration issue and social issues like abortion. He's trying to secure the Republican base. My guess is, again, only a guess, Romney is a middle-of-the-road Republican. He is in the old mold of maybe a bit to the right of Rockefeller and his father, George Romney. And I don't think he wants his presidency to be defined by victory in Iraq.
But that means we know what John McCain would say running against Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama about Iraq. We have no idea what George Romney would say, Mitt Romney, after he gets the nomination.
We don't. And I would guess that he will tack to the middle, as he's already doing on other issues, and would signal that he would do a kind of a Nixon and signal that although he will not lose, he will get us out somehow or other. It's amazing to think of how skillfully Richard Nixon ran in 68 without saying a word about how he would end the war, but kind of being all things to all people and letting Republicans know there would be honor and Democrats know there would be peace. No one has been able to do that in this campaign, and I think Romney would try something like that.
Well, again, I'll be very curious to see if they try to tease out differences between McCain and Romney on the war in the MSNBC debate in Florida tonight. We will have that debate at 11 o'clock tonight on AM 820 WNYC, and we will play clips to lead off this show tomorrow morning. We will continue in a minute with George Packer, New Yorker writer, author of The Assassin's Gate. We'll talk more about his Iraq play opening tomorrow for previews at Culture Project, 55 Mercer Street. It's called Betrayed, and his article in The New Yorker comparing Clinton and Obama's views of the presidency. So still a lot to do with George Packer, and we'll get to some of your calls if we have time. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.
Are you the one?
Are you the one?
You're the one?
I think the president got the big decision of his presidency right.
the big decision that he made on September 20th, 2001, when he put us on offense against Islamic terrorism. And I give him great credit for that. Mistakes have also been made. Mistakes were made particularly in the period of time after the capture of Saddam Hussein and now a year ago when we got to the surge policy.
Rudy Giuliani the other day, as we continue with George Packer. And George, your play, Betrayed, based on real life and real life people?
Yeah, I went back to Baghdad last January to interview Iraqis who had worked with Americans. And I didn't know quite what I would find. I was hearing rumors that they were in very bad shape. And what I found was that they were the most hunted, the most endangered Iraqis of all. They were hated by Sunni and Shiite militias alike. Even the Iraqi government considered them to be traitors. And the American government was doing almost nothing to protect them. They reminded me, in a way, of Jews in Europe in the early 40s, on the run, hiding, living double lives, either continuing to work in the green zone and hoping no one spotted them on their way home, not telling their family what they were doing, or trying to find a way out of the country. And we were making it almost impossible for them to come here. So I interviewed several dozen of them, and I've never quite had such a shaming experience hearing their stories. I asked them to tell me the whole story of the war from their point of view, and over again, it was a story of soaring hopes in early 2003. These were young Iraqis who saw nothing but darkness in their future under Saddam. Suddenly, the Americans arrive. It's beyond their wildest dreams, and slowly over the next 3 or 4 years, and very reluctantly, they realize that the Americans not only cannot bring the promised freedom and prosperity, but don't even seem to care about the promises that they made. And so it was, to me, sort of the epitome of what went wrong after the invasion in the individual stories. And they were very individual. And the voices sort of stayed in my head even after the article I wrote for The New Yorker was published, which is why I felt I wanted to do more with it.
And it is an outrage, and we've talked about this on this program before, with the translator for the slain American journalist, Stephen Vincent, a woman named Noura, who finally did get to come to this country. And she was marked by Al-Qaeda for having interpreted for an American journalist. And yet it took the American government forever to give her refugee status. So there are still a lot of translators who work not only for journalists, but directly with the U.S. government forces in limbo.
Absolutely. I mean, I think of a guy who I met in Iraq last January. He lived in southern Iraq, but he would only meet me in Kurdistan, not even in Baghdad. He didn't feel safe anywhere in the non-Kurdish part of Iraq. So we went up to Erbil, and we had 3 days of conversations. This guy started working for the U.S. military the day they entered his city in early 2003 and continued working with U.S. diplomats as an interpreter, and even more, as a fixer, as a go-between with the Mahdi army, as a guy who was living a double life and trying to create channels of communication between the Americans and people in the Mahdi army who wanted to talk, the most dangerous possible job. Well, he got a death threat when one of his Mahdi army contacts was killed, and the Mahdi army decided that he had been responsible. He's now in Jordan. He's been in Jordan for about 6 months. For a year, he's been under this death threat, and he still hasn't gotten a visa. Mm. And the question is why? And it's not as though no one is getting in. There's a trickle. If you've got a very powerful backer in this country who's willing to cut through the red tape, eventually I think you will get in here. But the bureaucracy is so clotted, and I think ultimately the White House has not been willing to signal to the bureaucracy that it wants this because politically it is a loser for the White House.
Let's take a call from somebody who read your New Yorker article on which the play is based. Sam in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sam.
Hi, nice to talk to you. I want to thank George for Betrayed, which is, you know, absolutely one of the most devastating and morally clear-headed pieces of reporting I've read about Iraq. And I wonder
thank
if George
you.
Could give us an update on Kirk Johnson and generally on the efforts to help those translators and other Iraqis who put themselves and their families in absolute peril to support America.
Right. Well, Kirk Johnson, for those who didn't read the article, is a young American who went to Iraq with high ideals and went to work for USAID, Agency for International Development, and was in Fallujah for a long time. and then had an accident when he came home and couldn't go back, and began to hear stories of Iraqi colleagues who were under threat and couldn't get out or couldn't get visas. And he has made it his life's work over the past year and a half, to help get them out. He has something called the List Project. And if you want to help, thelistproject.org will get you there, which has essentially began with Kirk just getting emails from Iraqis who heard he was helping and wanted his help. And now his list is over 1,000 Iraqis long, and he's essentially laid it on the desk of the relevant officials at the Department of State.
Wow.
And said, what are you going to do about this? And his frustration level over the course of the year has grown and grown, but he hasn't stopped, and I don't think he will stop. He's still working on this.
Were you saying listeners could help?
Absolutely. You can certainly write to your representatives. There are pro bono activities going on behalf of the refugees from law firms and from refugee advocates, which always can use financial support. The List Project will get you there, or else Refugees International or Human Rights First, which are heavily involved as well. So it's not as though no one is doing anything. In fact, in some weird way, everyone now knows about this. Hillary Clinton's talking about it on the campaign trail, and still nothing happens. And that's what's maddening. And that's why Kirk, last time I saw him a couple of nights ago, he was sort of at wit's end. What do we have to do to force the president's hand? And my idea is it's the veterans now who are going to have to do it, because they have the unimpeachable bona fides. They should go in front of the White House and say, save our Iraqi friends, because veterans care a lot about the interpreters that they left behind.
Is Kirk a character in the play?
There's a U.S. Embassy employee who is very loosely based on some things that happened to Kirk, but Kirk would be mortified if I said that the character was based on him.
New Yorker writer George Packer, my guest on WNYC, his play based on his experiences reporting in Iraq and taking off on that very long New Yorker article. I thought I was back in the pre-Tina Brown days.
Every now and then it happens.
Called Betrayed. The play opens at Culture Project 55 Mercer Street. Previews begin tomorrow. Cultureproject.org, is it? Their website for tickets. And Amir in Park Slope. You're on WNYC. Hi, Amir.
Hi, good morning. I just have a question and a comment. The question is, what is the state of local democracy in Iraq, meaning, what is the state of indigenous democracy in terms of, you know, council members, mayors being elected, even, you know, regional governors? That stuff isn't really talked about. And second question is, it's more of an observation of what I see with the political coverage of Iraq. I see a very narrow spectrum, and a typical example would be the recent New York Times Weekend Review article or the recent article by Goldberg in The Atlantic. And the problem is most of the citations are administration officials and center-left and center-right think tanks that have entrenched political interests with the Democrat or Republican Party, things like CSIS or Heritage Foundation. And these reflect, you know, establishment interests. And I'm wondering, how can you get objective, you know, information from these established interests? Wouldn't it be better to maybe use like a non-political or non-partisan university or think tank or professor that might not have that same sort of, you know, bias?
George, what do you think about that?
Well, the second question is it's a difficult one. I share some of your impatience with conventional wisdom on Iraq, because it's been wrong over and over, and a lot of it has come from those think tanks. But those are, I mean, the Brookings Institution is a nonpartisan think tank. It is certainly roughly center-left, but they don't endorse candidates. There is a bit of a revolving door between Brookings and various administrations. I don't think there's anything to do about that, and I don't think it by itself impeaches the credibility of Brookings. I mean, there's certainly places in the press and more left-of-center think tanks and more right-of-center think tanks where you're going to get more critical views of sort of the foreign policy establishment.
And
I think
that's
good.
And it always depends on the individual, no matter what institution they're associated with in that kind of world. And there are people who are more outside the system who may be more independent, but also might be more ideological.
And I mean, I take them as I find them. If I find that their methods and conclusions seem credible, then I don't ask myself, you know, who's behind them. But to get to your first question, which is a very interesting one, it really varies all over Iraq. I mean, there are parts of southern Iraq where I wouldn't call them democratic, but where local government is actually functioning pretty well. They're spending money on reconstruction projects. Najaf is a boom town, and has essentially told the rest of Iraq, stay out of our problems. We can solve them better than you can. Other parts of southern Iraq have done the same. From what I hear, Nineveh province, which has been a real epicenter of the war, has calmed down to some extent. And the difficulty is in assessing what people's lives are like. It may well be that there's reconstruction going on, violence is down, but I think in most parts of Iraq, people are living under the control of some armed group that is basically arbitrary and not connected to the government or to the public interest. And that means you're living in the gaps between different militias, and that's where most Iraqis' lives are today.
By the way, for those of you who might want to read that original New Yorker article that George's new play is based on, that was in the January 22nd New York. No?
March 26th.
March 26th New Yorker. That was the Betrayed article. He has one in the new New Yorker about Clinton's and Obama's view of the presidency. I want to ask your reaction about one of those think tankers who was prominently quoted on the front page of the Times Week in Review section, Anthony Cordesman, this week. He's a retired general, I think, something like that. And
I don't think so. I think he's a long-time defense analyst.
Defense analyst.
Yeah.
But he had a fascinating quote, and I wonder if you agree with it, rating the candidates in the New York Times on Sunday. And here's what he said. He said, you have to grade all the candidates between a D- and an F+. The Republicans are talking about this as if we have won and as if Iraq is the center of the war on terrorism rather than Afghanistan and Pakistan and a host of movements in 50 other countries. The Democrats talk about this as if the only problem is to withdraw and the difference is over how quickly to do it.
I think he's on the money. Cordesman is he's a kind of a cantankerous, independent-minded think tanker. He doesn't take anything from anybody. He hasn't had a lot of time on the ground in Iraq, but his experience in other wars and his analytical abilities and basically his ability to think for himself are impressive. And he wrote a report recently that's one of the best I've seen coming out of one of those dreaded centrist think tanks, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, that analyzed the whole array of political and military realities in Iraq and was about as complicated and nuanced and kind of hard to summarize as you can imagine. And that's Iraq. And the candidates are simplifying it and narrowing it down and basically telling their base what it wants to hear. I think Anthony Cordesman has it right.
We have 1 minute left. I want to read one line from one of the characters in your play. I was reading the script last night, and I think I can do this without giving away any plot, and I won't even say which character it is, who says, betrayed, which is the title of the play, betrayed, no, not disappointed. I can never blame the Americans alone. It's the Iraqis who destroyed their country with the help of the Americans under the American eye. Is that your opinion?
Yes, it is. And that's a direct quote from one of the people I interviewed last January, and a portion of the script comes from those Iraqis because their voices are so powerful, as that one is. I mean, imagine having gone through all that that man went through, having lost everything and become an exile in Sweden, of all places, and still seeing what happened in his country so objectively, so completely, seeing his own people's responsibility, seeing the Americans' responsibility, that kind of full vision of the war, it may take a certain amount of suffering to get to it, and it's what most Americans have not been able to get to. We want our blame to be simple. We want it to be one side or the other. It just can't be that way.
George Packer, New Yorker writer, Assassin's Gate author, and now the playwright of Betrayed, which opens for previews tomorrow at Culture Project, 55 Mercer Street. You can get tickets through cultureproject.org, and we've placed a link to that on our show page. You can go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. George, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, we continue our January series on working out. And we will talk about weight training and strength building. Is it more than just Charles Atlas? Stay with us.
Are you the one?
Are you the one?